All right, welcome on to a Thursday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, and I have someone on as a guest who is either very aggrieved or very happy. I'm not sure which because of the performance of Kristaps Porzingis so far, Kevin Pelton.
I don't know if my emotions are that tied to the performance of Kristaps Porzingis.
Well, you lamented the fact that you might be like pushed down another rung on like the KP rankings. You'll always be KP to me, by the way. Like whenever we play basketball, I always like KP is like how I try to get your attention. But so that hurts. You know, Kevin Pritchard already may have slightly eclipsed you. I hope that I'm not hurting your feelings to say that. And Porzingis, maybe at least in the hearts of Knicks fans so far, may have ascended up the rankings above you.
Well, to me, there's got to be a chronological order to this. So when I started going down to Portland in 2008, Pritchard was already the GM, and Ben Golliver, now at SI.com, dubbed me KP2 to avoid confusion with Pritchard, which then became funny when I ultimately ended up working for Kevin Pritchard in Indiana, and he actually would call me KP2. So I've heard...
I didn't know that part, that he was actually in on it.
Oh, yes, totally in on the joke. It's great. Taz Mellis, shout out to him, defended my honor that KP... Kristaps Porzingis can't have the KP nickname. He pointed out, I think, Kenny Powers and I on the starters a couple days ago.
Yeah, that's true. And also, there's so many other puns and permutations of Kristaps Porzingis that I think limiting it to KP like might be a disservice to him and all of the other pun makers out there, my frequent co-host Danny LaRue among them.
Yeah, you know, there's really explore the studio space here. There's a lot to do.
But anyway, the reason why I think you'd be happy is because you were very high on Porzingis going into the draft, and now it appears that that opinion, at least so far, is looking correct. What has he done that you anticipated? What has he done that is maybe ahead of schedule or a skill that you didn't necessarily think would be something he would exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall I'd say it hasn't exactly been what I expected in terms of, you know, how he would succeed because – you know, his scoring efficiency was probably a relatively big factor in that playing in Spain, and he hasn't been an efficient scorer yet whatsoever. I mean, even with the game against Charlotte the other night where he went off and had probably his best offensive game, it's really been much more about how dominant he's been as a rebounder on both ends of the court. His ability to create shots, I think, is fairly consistent with what we expected, and then, you know, his block rate, that's fairly consistent, but... I guess fairly consistent is probably too strong because he's got a higher usage right now, I think, than he did in the ACB, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think he was 25%, I want to say, last year. And last time I checked for him this year, he was kind of right around that same thing. And that's just, you just don't see rookies with a usage that high generally. I mean, I think when I looked at it last year, you know, seeing one or two of the rookies to have a usage rate above average, I thought was actually pretty encouraging. But you know, obviously there are a bunch more this year that have that as well. I mean, I think for his inefficiency, a lot of that probably if he just started taking more threes instead of 2-point jumpers, I think that would be a big help there, huh?
Yeah, and he also presumably is going to regress to the mean from 3-point range. He's only hitting 26.5% there so far, but he's more talented than that.
Yeah, that's true. Now, what I didn't anticipate was just his ability to be so effective just in the effort categories and having that as kind of a backstop for his performance. I mean, I thought he would definitely have some games where he would heat up from outside this year. I thought he would sort of be, you know, maybe he would get the start because they didn't have a lot of options there, but he'd be one of these guys who'd play 20 minutes a game. Maybe towards the end of the year he might start finishing some games, but... you know, they'd kind of get beat up defensively when he was on the floor, and that's not the case. They've actually defended fantastically, even though he's playing a lot of his minutes at power forward.
Right, and the one thing I completely agreed with you about after watching him play a lot during the preseason was, you know, I didn't think there was any way he's going to be able to defend stretch fours out on the perimeter because he just doesn't move. What stands out to me is he doesn't really bend at the knees very well defensively. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And he still has struggled on occasion with closeouts. We also, as far as I can recall, have not seen any teams try to go small against him and see what happens when you do that. I mean, I think it, then he could, if you have, are forcing him to guard a guy who can shoot threes and put the ball on the floor just a little bit with a closeout, I think that that's something that could cause him some problems. And but, you know, maybe teams are going to be so scared of him posting up that they're just not going to do that. I don't think that's the right choice, but maybe we will see that. Is there anything about his performance that you think is unsustainable in, in the positive direction? It's going to revert back.
I don't know. I mean, we've already seen his offensive rebound rate drop a little bit, and I don't think that he's probably going to be able to stay quite that much of a threat on the offensive glass, especially this is, you know, kind of almost a positive. If he starts shooting the ball better and, you know, you really want him spacing the court, you don't want him crashing the offensive glass as much. So that, I think, is something that probably will go away at some point.
Yeah, and I also think he's really benefited on the defensive glass from playing next to Robin Lopez, who's a guy that we've seen in previous stops, may not get a ton of defensive rebounds himself, but is excellent boxing out and allowing opportunities for others. I actually was worried about his ability on the defensive glass just because he's so thin. But, I mean, they're just that's the other thing. He's gotten strong enough, and this is also, you know, a new NBA where you don't, you know, not every team has like Dale Davis or Antonio Davis or Charles Oakley at power forward the way they used to, guys who are just going to beast you. So I think maybe his lack of strength isn't as much of an issue. He's been able to make up for it with his length quite a bit, and he's gotten stronger. So, I mean, there, the number of times where he just, like, has gotten beasted on the boards or trying to post up or whatever, you know, I can only remember a few of those times.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I expected it much more frequently. As far as Lopez, there was one play that stood out to me the other night watching that game where, you know, both of them are right there under the glass, and Porzingis just goes up and basically takes the rebound out of Lopez's hands. And it feels like Robin Lopez is probably the center in the league who is most okay with that.
Yeah, and we could say DeAndre Jordan would be at the opposite end of those rankings. So let's talk now a little bit more about that the draft as a whole. We are about, I don't know, 10 games in, 12 games in for most of these teams. Now, you had a comment in one a piece that you co-wrote with Chad Ford talking about Porzingis, in which you said you kind of had Russell and Porzingis rated equally highly going into the draft, but now because you would weight NBA performance higher than pre-draft expectations, you'd have Porzingis higher. Is 12 games really significant enough to say that? And how much can we really read into 12 games so far, assuming that the guys are playing a reasonable amount?
Yeah, I don't think it's enough to move guys dramatically, to move guys from maybe one tier to another. But if they're relatively in the same tier, I think it can be enough to shift those perceptions. Because it's not just 12 games. We also have, you know, what we've seen of them in summer league. We also have what we've seen of them in preseason. And some of the red flags that we saw with Russell in summer league, you know, that you, I think, were highlighting as much as anyone, have certainly reared their ugly head at times during the regular season. But I think it's less, you know, for me, about what Russell isn't doing, other than the fact that he isn't getting the free throw line, and more about just the fact that Porzingis has been so good that I think it really has, first off, convinced me that that projection for him that you know, he and Russell were tied for the best warp projection purely by the numbers, that was probably spot on, and maybe even undersold him a little.
Yeah, and you also wrote that maybe, you know, it's not time to panic yet on Russell as far as him being an effective player. I think it's might be time to panic about him being like a super duper star, which I think is kind of what people were thinking the Lakers needed, hoped for with the number two pick. You know, and I still think he's someone who can be a solid starting point guard in the league. He has a lot of pretty good strengths, especially if he can get his shooting up to a level. He's had some nice plays with his right hand recently, which has kind of alleviated some of the concerns I had there, and that he's really going to need to finish at the basket. But just as far as his performance, what have you seen both from the numbers and watching him that might cast either positive or negatively on his future?
Well, the interesting thing about his numbers, and this is now even stronger than when Chad and I discussed him on Monday, is he's actually been reasonably effective in terms of advanced stats. I have him ninth among all rookies in wins above replacement, and you know, one of a handful of guys who's actually getting real minutes who has been above replacement level, which, you know, for example, guys like Emmanuel Mudiay and Jahlil Okafor do not rate that by my numbers. But watching him play, I mean, you know, I think it's the same thing that you're saying. He's obviously not getting to the basket, driving to get all the way to the basket almost at all. And because of that, he's not, you know, setting up great value-added passes very frequently. That's pretty much only in transition at this point when he's making those kind of plays. Maybe when teams overhelp off the pick and roll, then he's able to kind of suck in that defender and dish those cross-court fastballs that he likes to throw. But he has been a pretty effective mid-range shooter thus far, and you know, if there's more space on the court, if he's running more of the spread pick and roll like you and Danny have talked about, then I think that, you know, he could become a lot more effective offensively.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that we're, at least this year, we're just not going to see him playing. They don't have the type of shooters. They have these other guys who have the ball in their hands. They don't really play a ton of, they'll play plenty of pick and roll, but not necessarily spread pick and roll. You know, and it's also pretty hard to do with Roy Hibbert on the floor as well, and then Randall, who's a non-shooter at the four. And on the few times where he's gotten the ball in his hands and been able to find shooters on the weak side, that was one of his big strengths as well when he was playing at Ohio State. So I do think he could be put in a better position to succeed, and I think he can be a quality point guard in the league in time, if not quite having the athleticism to be an enormous star. All right, so let's do a redraft here. I mean, maybe we'll do, let's do like top 10.
Okay.
All right. So number one, who you got?
Obviously Towns.
Yeah. No question about it. I forget who it was. Oh yeah. Yeah. Zach Lowe said that he actually has been the Wolves' best player so far. Would you agree with that?
I would. Yeah. I mean, you can certainly make a case.
He's so good defensively. It's remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, I thought he was really good at Kentucky, and he has looked even better than he did at Kentucky so far.
Yeah, and they haven't been going to him that much. They haven't had much shooting around him. They haven't really explored what he can do from the three-point line either. I mean, you know, they've been going to him pretty much for a rookie, but he hasn't been asked to create kind of one-on-one. But he, in the first half yesterday, he destroyed Nikola Vucevic, and to the point where Scott Skiles wouldn't even play Vucevic in the second half. So, and he did that by shooting jumpers and then driving past him and close out. There's a lot of centers that he's going to be able to beat that way ultimately.
Yeah, and his usage rate is actually up over 24%. So that's not bad at all for a 19-year-old center.
Yeah, and a lot of that he's been doing on the offensive glass as well. All right, who's your number two?
Porzingis.
Yeah, this one is tough for me. I thought it should be Jahlil when he was drafted back at draft time. It's just so hard to get a read on him in the other categories, but I do think that I've seen enough from him to believe that he can be the fantastic post scorer ultimately that people believed in. If he's playing in a real NBA ecosystem, I think against all but the stoutest post defenders, he's someone who's going to be able to draw a double team in the post. The free throw shooting hasn't been as bad as people were kind of concerned about, although he's not actually getting to the line that much when you consider how much he's actually posting up. But on the other hand, his defense has probably been, in some ways, maybe even worse than I thought it would be, and the plan to play him less minutes hasn't really seemed to materialize. So I don't know. I think I'm going to stick with him for now, though, and just with the hope that he can be I think he still has good enough tools to be pretty decent defensively and can continue to get into better shape both from a cardio and a physical standpoint. So I think I would stick with him at two. What have you thought of Okafor so far, and is it even close to you between him and Porzingis or no?
I don't think it is because, again, you know, I think you could argue that they were on relatively similar, you know, in roughly similar in terms of actually advanced stats. Porzingis was way higher entering the draft, but you know, Porzingis again has elevated his you know, realistic outcome so much. Whereas I think Okafor right now, the defining thing for me with him is he is what we thought he was.
Yeah, and in some respects that's good, in some respects that's bad. And I'm open to the possibility that I could be wrong on Porzingis, and this is actually one of those things where, I mean, I think Okafor will probably always be a better one-on-one scorer than Porzingis is, and so it's just how much are you going to rate that, the ability to draw a double team. I mean, it's very much kind of old school, new school, whereas Porzingis, if he ends up being a center who can shoot, you know, 37% on threes. I don't know that I see Porzingis as getting to be like a true like 40% guy on threes, but still a center who can shoot 37-38% on threes at a high volume, which, you know, he gets his shot off really easily. He can even come off screens now and then as well for shots, and then to be able to, you know, hold up defensively, block some shots at the rim on the other end. I mean, that's just a tremendously, tremendously valuable player, even if it's not kind of a scoring superstar in the traditional sense.
Yeah, and the fact that he's already able to sustain such a high usage, I think, suggests that, you know, there'll be ways for him to score, even if it's not strictly as a three-point shooter.
Yeah, and he's on the offensive glass as well. So, all right, so three, who do you got at three then?
I'm still going to go with Russell here. You know, there's more positives in his stat line than I think people think. I mentioned his steal rate on Twitter the other day, and he's also rebounding like an above-average shooting guard and an adequate small forward. So, you know, there's positives to be taken here.
Why him over Moutier?
I am still a little uncomfortable with, you know, how long it's going to take Moutier basically to overcome his weaknesses. Because, you know, while he's done a lot of very exciting things, and the high usage rate he has, the high assist rate, everything like that points to long-term positives, he's really not very good right now.
Yeah, I mean, and is that because of the turnovers? Is that the biggest thing? I mean, because that's something that for rookies can sometimes be more of a positive indicator, because you assume that they're going to ultimately get those down. It's the two-point shooting that's kind of the big red flag for me so far.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, he's shooting 33% inside the arc, and that's
actually up. He was like 9 for 38 at one point.
Yeah. Yeah, so his true shooting percentage is still under 40% right now.
And I think, like me, you probably don't make a ton out of the fact that he's actually like shot the three okay. It's probably just not enough of a size to really conclude anything there.
Yeah, and his free throw percentage is still worrisome, 65% so far. So he's got a long ways to go as a shooter. I think he's kind of in that point. Like, remember Rubio's rookie year where everyone was so excited about all the things he could do? And then, you know, the next couple of years, the things he can't do start to get progressively more annoying. I think Moutier will probably develop more than Rubio has, because Rubio has largely been the same player since age 17. And it's still very good, for sure. But
yeah,
I think it's a case like that where, you know, it's the new toy. Look at all these things he can do. And the other thing I pointed out the other day in our discussion with Chad Ford is his game is much more vineable than D'Angelo Russell's.
Yeah, that's true. Although Russell will start getting to the point where he throws some more passes too, that'll probably get in there. I think I would go with Moutier at three. Again, I'm still just a little bit too tied to my pre-draft evaluation of Porzingis, and I could regret that. Porzingis will be a clear number four for me, but I really like what Moutier has done. Point guards can take a little bit longer to develop. I think he's going to be a fantastic defensive player in time, and having the fact that he has the versatility to really switch probably 1 through 3 and even hold up okay on fours, a lot of fours with his strength, is something that's going to be really, really helpful for teams. I do worry about his two-point shooting. I think, though, with his athleticism, he can get to be a good finisher right at the basket in time. And it just, you know, he's still got to work on his jump shot, but that's probably the easiest thing that there is to fix. And the turnovers, which is also something that, you expect to improve over time. So just, this may be relying on the eye test a little bit too much for me to still have him at three. And, you know, a couple more weeks of Porzingis really playing well, if he can get his efficiency up a little bit, it could change that for me, to be sure.
Yeah.
All right, number four.
I would go Moutier fourth.
All right, and I'll go Porzingis. I think we talked both about that. Five, it kind of gets pretty interesting.
Well, I still haven't taken Okafor, so I think I'm going with him.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah, I guess that's true. Who am I missing then?
Russell out of my top four.
Whew, let's see. That's where it gets kind of interesting for me, too. I mean, I guess the other candidates would be Stanley Johnson, who actually has a pretty high usage rate, but is shooting very poorly. Winslow, who came back to earth the other day a little bit, and you know, still has not impressed that much as an offensive player, but his defense has been fantastic. And then the last guy, I would even put Cauley-Stein and Turner in that discussion a little bit. Yeah, I'm a little torn here. I mean, I'm not going to put a ton of thought into that. I think I ultimately will go with, I think Miles Turner would actually be my pick there. I mean, I like what I've seen from his shooting. His shot blocking is fantastic. I mean, this is potential injury problems aside. But, you know, I think all those guys I kind of would put, even Cauley-Stein, Johnson, Winslow, and Turner, I would put kind of in the same tier at this point now.
And I would generally agree with that, which might make this not that useful of a redraft outside the top five, because, you know, at that point it would probably come down more to need than, you know, those guys having dramatically different potentials than each other.
Yeah, okay, all right. So you think Cauley-Stein, I think, is someone who your numbers were not particularly high on. Have you... am I right about that, or am I misremembering?
No, you are definitely right about that.
So it sounds like then you've come around on him to some degree if you're willing to put him in that tier.
Yeah, I mean, I was always higher on him than the numbers because, you know, I can watch him play defense as much as the next guy. But the one thing in particular I think that has encouraged me about Cauley-Stein is the fact that he's rebounding the ball quite well. And that was something he didn't do at Kentucky, but he was playing with, you know, Karl Anthony Towns, and before that.
Yeah, and Trey Lyles was playing the three right there as well. So, yeah.
So I think there's definitely a case where a lot of those Kentucky guys, there was just so much competition for stats that it made those guys look not as good as they are. So he's been a league average center on the glass so far, and that's much better than I feared with him.
Yeah, and he's even playing next to Cousins, who also gets a ton of rebounds as well. And I think just his ability to... You know, I don't think he's ever going to be able to hit a shot outside of 3 feet, but maybe, you know, he might have a couple of those seasons like Tyson Chandler did where he was able to hit a 15-footer okay, but then they'll decide, oh, wait a minute, there's no reason to have this guy ever shooting that shot even if he can make it because he can roll to the rim so effectively, and then he's able to switch out as well. So although I think the Kings probably should have taken Moutier at that point, you know, Cauley-Stein, I think, is going to end up being a fine pick, other than the fact that, you know, he plays the same position as your best player. But it, just in terms of value, I didn't have as much of a problem with that pick just in terms of, like, how good of a player I think he will be. Notably absent from both of our, I guess we're almost at top 10 now, Mario Hezonja.
Yeah, I mean, he has not been very good this season when he's been on the court.
Yeah, well, so... How much of that at this point is, and I touched on this earlier, I wanted you to elaborate on it, you know, the pre-draft expectations angle. I mean, is that something that you actually have looked at, of whether, you know, 10 games, 20 games, how long does it take before that really should completely overwhelm our pre-draft expectations for somebody?
You know, I haven't looked at it from that standpoint. What I've looked at is, you know, after someone's rookie season, how much does the pre-draft ranking add? And at that point, it's not a ton. It definitely, you know, your performance in the NBA is a much better indicator. So it's kind of a question of trying to then weigh that with how much does 10 games tell us about the ultimate performance the rest of the season, which is more than nothing, but not everything.
Yeah, and especially for guys who haven't been playing that much as well, I think it can be difficult. But Hezonja is someone that a lot of people really liked. I was the least familiar with him of anybody in the top 10, which I've freely admitted, and I wish I had seen more of him beforehand. But based on what I did know, you know, I thought he would be kind of like J.R. Smith, maybe like a little bit better defensively, and someone who could be a valuable player, certainly. But I did not really see the like big star potential with him as far as his ability to really create off the dribble that maybe some other people did.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I thought that the J.R. Smith comp was pretty fair as well. You know, a couple of things that are concerning. I mean, he's shooting the ball well from three-point range, not really shooting the two well, but his rebound rate has been horrendous so far, and that is not something that I think I expected. You know, if you're talking about his athletic potential, he should be more effective in that regard.
Well, I think he's kind of one of those guys who, yeah, he gets some pretty good dunks, and so you think of him as athletic. I'm actually going to do a little segment on this in a future podcast of, I'll call them the Rudy Gay All-Stars of guys who, you know, can jump really high and get a lot of dunks, but don't actually like do a ton in the athletic categories. And have a ton of lateral quickness, although maybe Hezonja actually is not terrible in that category, so maybe he doesn't fit in. But in any event, let's move on now to what we've seen so far this year. You wrote a good way to segue into that is the piece that you wrote on the Rockets yesterday, shortly after they moved on from McHale, and you had some interesting conclusions in that about how preseason expectations for a team weigh in versus what their performance is throughout the season to date.
Yes, that was convenient. I actually had a piece that I wrote Tuesday looking at the Rockets and the Pelicans, how to kind of project them for the rest of the season based on, you know, their slow starts and what we knew about them going into the year. So then was kind of able to tweak that a little bit and incorporate the coaching change factor when I woke up Wednesday morning and found out about McHale.
Yeah, what did you think of that move?
I don't know. I mean, I don't have strong feelings about it either way. It does feel a little troublingly results-based for an organization that, you know, usually prides itself on focusing more on process than results. But at the same time, I wonder, you know, everyone talks about, oh, you just gave McHale a 3-year extension, but did they feel kind of boxed in that they had to do that after they won 56 games and got to the conference finals? Like, how in the
world? Well, they gave him that extension, like, early on last season, though. It was like December or something, I think, it's when they gave him that extension.
Okay, well, maybe, I guess not the conference finals part of it. But
yeah, but I think your point still holds. Though,
yeah, that I don't think that
where they were.
I don't think that they were ever that Morey was ever in love with Kevin McHale. Is the
yeah, they weren't going to have him as like a lame duck coach. I mean, because when he was hired, they were kind of more at a developmental phase. I think where it wasn't like, all right, we need to get some master tactician who's going to kind of hold up in the playoffs. Although, you know, I don't think McHale was fired due to his playoff performance. Maybe you could have argued that he should have been after 2014.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was more just that I think they needed something. And McHale, I don't think anyone would say that he did a bad job there overall, but I don't think anyone would say he did some awesome job either. And I think, you know, I've posited this before that just nobody really knows who's going to be a great coach until they, you know, unless they've already been really good in the NBA. I mean, you can ask around, you can have an idea, but, you know, plenty of really well-regarded assistants have failed. Plenty of sort of boring hires have really succeeded and come out of nowhere. I mean, that's some of the best coaches in NBA history. So if you don't, the theory for me is if you don't have a great coach, maybe it's better to actually kind of cycle through more coaches just in the hopes of giving yourself another chance at finding that awesome coach.
It's an interesting theory and something I've considered a lot because I do think there's something to be said for stability in that position, especially if you're kind of swerving wildly between one direction and the other, which, you know, a lot of teams tend to do. You'll hire the opposite of whoever the past coach you have was. But the Rockets, I don't think, are really doing that by promoting J.B. Bickerstaff. He's, you know, already was running their, you know, heavily involved in running their defense last season. And a big part of their philosophy, and we know kind of what their philosophy is going to look like offensively. So it's not like they're changing directions dramatically. I think it's more about, you know, just if McHale, you didn't think he was a great coach and he wasn't getting through to the players, which he evidently at this point wasn't, then, you know, I guess it does make sense to make a change.
Yeah, and I also thought Danny and I talked about a little bit about this on last night's program, but some of the comments from the owner. Can you ever remember hearing comments like that from an owner of just like, I knew we were going to lose, like we were just laying down? Like that's like, and especially for an owner who has long been praised in Les Alexander for kind of staying out of the spotlight and letting the GM do his job. I thought that those were some pretty remarkable comments.
Yeah, I thought it was surprising that he had that much to say just in the first place, and then for it to be as strong as it was. I wonder what he felt in the second quarter when they were up 15 on the Celtics. Whether he thought
he said I thought, I think what he said was I even then I thought we were going to lose, which is like that's surprising to me. So, you know, just because those comments were made, it makes you think that maybe there was some pressure there. Although I'm not saying I disagree with the move. I think that they did need to do something. But your piece, I thought, was really interesting. And I'm going from memory here, so correct me if I'm wrong. But basically, the conclusion, I think, was that preseason expectations, which you set with basically the Vegas line, which has a pretty decent predictive history, counts for about 20 games. So what I took that to mean was, if a team has gone, you know, their preseason expectation is 500 and they've won every game, but of every game of their first 20 games, you'd expect them, it's half the preseason expectation and half the performance to date at that point, essentially. So you would expect them to play like 750 ball going forward.
Yep, that's a pretty good way to summarize it. And, you know, that's consistent with, in the past, I've been going on Neil Payne's research when he was writing for ESPN Insider before he was at 538, and he found, I think, 25 games, which is what I used in the past. Then for what I was previously working on, the original version of that Rockets story, I went and looked at, you know, because both the Rockets at that point had played 11 games and the Pelicans were about to have played 11 games, went back through every team back through the merger, their first 11 games. And then, well, I had to cut that down for the because I only have preseason lines back to 05-06. But, you know, what predicted their final record the best using a combination of those? And it was, you know, through 11 games, it's about a 2-1, almost 2-1 preseason expectations to performance to date. But that kind of implies that it's a 20 games worth of data.
So with that as a background, who can we, do you think we can reliably just count out of the playoff race right now?
Okay, so it's not as many teams, I think, probably as you would expect at this point in the season.
And Lakers are done, right?
Lakers, Sixers, and it's Sixers.
They're 2-9. Sixers are 0-12. Obviously, they're done. Brooklyn, 2-10, they're done. Sorry, so you're not putting New Orleans in that category.
Well, I was just going with the from most obvious to.
Okay.
I think that New Orleans, a couple days ago, I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, but now you're at a point where to even go 500, you have to win, you know, about at a 48 win pace, and I think they might be able to do that once they get Tyreek back in the lineup. But until then, I have a hard time seeing it.
Yeah, and there's still not really a timetable for his return. Norris Cole is not back either. I think he's someone even who might help them a little bit. You know, AD, I think you can count on him. You know, he's got this shoulder thing. We don't know what the timetable is there. It sounds like a short-term thing, but, you know, we can probably count on him missing 10 more games based on his injury history. So, yeah, I mean, I think I am kind of about ready to declare them done, which might be a good thing for the organization ultimately, because I had lamented that because they traded draft picks to get higher salary players, that they weren't really going to necessarily have a way to improve in free agency. They didn't have the guys that they drafted with those picks. And now at least they'll have one more cheap piece. They're going to have to hit on it. But if they could get a guy who's a solid starter within a couple of years with this probable lottery pick that they're going to get, that, I think, could change the fortunes of this franchise if Davis can continue to develop at the rate that we hope for him.
I think the worry there with the Pelicans is, given their history, do they try to trade that pick again or make some kind of win now move? You know, are they this year's Hornets?
Yeah, well, if they could actually get something for it, maybe that would work. That would work well. But yeah, I mean, it's gonna be really interesting for them now. Eric Gordon actually has been probably the one guy, at least offensively, who's played pretty decently again this year. I mean, I think I haven't looked at his stats recently, but he's had some pretty big games. Ryan Anderson looks like he actually is kind of back offensively as well to being the player that we thought. He had 30 last night. Although I think he's not quite the physical in the physical shape that he was before he went through those back injuries. But those guys are now free agents, and so they'll have $20 million in space, but they also are going to need to either bring those guys back or replace them.
They're in an interesting spot. I mean, one thing is, I think there was a chance where if everything broke right and they had won, 50 games this year, where, they become a player in the free agent market. Someone wants to go join up with Anthony Davis, go play there. And now I think that scenario is hard to see. So it's probably more likely they're back to trying to re-sign their own guys.
All right. So those kind of four teams, I think we could – then we can safely conclude that they're out of it. Do you feel that way about, are you ready to cross New Orleans off the list yet or no?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I think I probably am too. I mean, they would really, and it's just, all right, if they had everyone healthy at this very moment right now, all right, I think I'd be willing to not cross them off. But considering that, like, it looked like they had righted the ship for a time, now they've gotten blown out again these last couple of games, I think there's, the problem is that I think you have to sort of like they might even still be going down further into the valley before they even start driving uphill again. So yeah, I mean, I think given that I'm ready to cross them off too. Anyone else?
I guess actually the specific moment where I was ready to write off the Pelicans is when they ran out that starting lineup last night.
That's right. That's exactly what I said. Like when John Reed, their beat writer, tweeted that out, I was like, I think we're done here.
Yeah, it was fun while it lasted. Actually, it wasn't that fun.
Yeah.
Portland, I think, would be the next team probably on the list. I mean, the East, everyone is so close to the playoff race still. I mean, it's a game and a half separating fourth through 13th in the conference. And most of those teams were teams, I think the Knicks were the only team that you probably had is unlikely to make the playoffs going into the season. So I don't know that any of those teams I would cross off. Sacramento's been good enough with Boogie that I don't think you can cross them off. So Portland would probably be the other candidate, even though they're not playing as badly as their record would indicate. Their point differential is actually the second best of anyone outside the playoffs in the West and ninth overall in the conference.
Yeah, they've lost seven straight, basically all seven. Both they and the Hawks, when they were 7-1 and Portland was, I think still had a winning record. I wrote a piece saying, hey, we had these preseason expectations. Maybe we should reevaluate. And then they both have been terrible since I wrote that piece. So I was higher on Portland, I think, than some people were. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, their defense, it seems like now, has regressed back to what we thought it would be. McCollum was shooting incredibly well from mid-range and even from three in a way that I think was a little bit unsustainable. And if they don't have Lillard and McCollum just killing it offensively, I think they also actually even miss Myers Leonard, who's been out, I think, the last four or five games. Although he's not very good defensively, I think the spacing that he provides at the four is something that they've been unable to duplicate elsewhere. So, yeah, I don't know. I think I would be getting pretty close to writing them off as well, but see if they can get one more homestand, and if they can't make up any ground there, it might be time.
Yeah, they're still ninth in offensive rating, so they're scoring points. The one thing that really stands out to me is, in related to the close losses, is Lillard has no room to operate late in games. And for the small minority of, extreme LaMarcus Aldridge haters who are like, this guy is worthless, all he does is shoot a bunch of mid-range shots, I think the effect that his absence has had on Lillard late in games is, pretty dramatic indication of the fact that he is quite valuable offensively.
All right, well, let's if we go through every team like this, we're never going to get you out of here. But what are you thinking about now? You want to just kind of go through each conference and kind of say who we think is going to get each seed? Is that too complex, or can we do that?
I think that's workable.
All right, let's start in the East, which I actually think is a lot more interesting. The Bulls and Cleveland now are tied atop the conference, the Bulls having the tiebreaker, which I'm going to say is probably not going to come into relevance between them and Cleveland ultimately at the end of the year. So are we in agreement then that Cleveland is looking like the number one seed, especially given how well they've played with some of their injury problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've done what I kind of expected. I was not as worried about them coming into the season as people who didn't pick them first in the East. And
people like me.
I'm not thinking of anyone in particular. Yeah, so no.
I'm shocked at how well they've been able to defend with some of the injury issues that they had. I thought they were really, really going to miss Shumpert as well, but yeah, they've been pretty good. Yeah, so I think we can say Cleveland is number one, but who is going to be the number two seed in this conference? That's very interesting.
So the best point differential in the conference after them is the Boston Celtics.
That's correct. Yeah, even after kind of a rough loss yesterday when they blew like a 20-point lead.
I'm still not ready to. I'm just living and dying every night with that Celtics projection this year.
Did you have them projected number two?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, and they have looked pretty good. Been a little worried that Marcus Smart has kind of fallen back to earth lately after he had that game against Westbrook. It's pretty funny that Westbrook was like, all right, yeah, he had one good game. Let's see him do it every night. And then he's like been like 1-for-20 over the last two games after that game, that great game against Westbrook. All right, so you're sticking with the Celtics, huh?
Well, reluctantly, yes, I guess I am.
Yeah, I am really torn here. I'm not buying the Bulls at all. They have been a way better record than their point differential, although a lot of that is that one really ugly loss that they had at Charlotte. But, you know, I think that they are just – opponents' three-point shooting has been really bad. They've just been kind of – just haven't looked good watching them. I mean, you know, they're relying on, like, Jimmy Butler isolations late in games and – Kirk Heinrich going 6 out of 7 from the field in like his best game since 2011. And, you know, so yeah, I think I would have them kind of more in the fourth, fifth seed. And also the fact when Derrick Rose is going to miss at least 20 games this year, I'm still not buying their backup point guard situation at all. I think they may have to make a move there ultimately if they just over the course of the regular season, although I'll make the charitable assumption that Rose will be healthy for the playoffs. I'd have them kind of in the fourth or fifth range. I guess I'll go Miami. Although I do also worry that guys like Johnson and Winslow are going to regress on that second unit that's fueled a lot of what they've been doing, but I don't feel particularly strongly about that.
Yeah, to me, I think this next group of three or four, probably including the Celtics, you can probably throw a blanket over all of them, and it'll be about equally likely. Miami, you know, third best point differential, I should say, second best of these teams in the conference. But they've played 7 of their first 10 games at home, and it feels like every game they play is against a bad team.
Yeah, or a team that's like has some injury problems.
Right.
Maybe the more interesting question then, because I'm having, who do we put in that second tier? I would put Miami. I would definitely put Boston so far. Who else do you have in that tier? Are you putting the Bulls in that tier?
I am, yeah. Even though their point differential is not great, I still think, you know, first off, those wins are banked, and we have enough of a track record that I'd put them in there.
And I think Mirotić can play better for them as well. That he's had a really rough last few games. I mean, ultimately, you know, maybe we start to worry at some point about him, but I think his shooting can get better, and I think Rose can't possibly play any worse when he comes back either. And you know, who knows how much this double vision thing has been a problem.
Toronto has to be in this tier, even though they actually wouldn't make the playoffs if the season ended today. But their point differential is really solid. They've played 9 out of their first 13 games at home. And when you factor all
on the road.
Or on the road, yes. And BPI actually has them second in terms of projected wins in the conference.
Yeah, they've lost 3 straight games, 3 tough games, you know, that it's no shame to lose on that West Coast trip. It would have been nice if they could have gotten one of those, but they're still 7-6, and I think the defense looks better, and the offense has held up okay. And they've played some tough offenses recently as well. So, yeah, I would absolutely put them in that tier. Is Atlanta in that tier for you?
I think they are. I think that, you know, they've obviously come back to earth a little bit the last few games, and I still worry about
partially due to injuries with Teague and Bazemore being out.
Yeah, I still... I'm skeptical that Bazemore is going to be a 40% plus 3-point shooter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there have definitely been some Hawks reserves who have surprised us with their ability to come out of nowhere, you know, the Damari Carroll effect. but we'll see about that. One thing that is kind of amusing, Tim Hardaway has not played a single minute yet this year. I mean, granted, all right, maybe they think they can develop him, whatever. And you know, it was the coach who traded for them. You know, he's the GM. He signed off on that. So it's not like the GM is giving the coach a player that he didn't want. And I just, you know, it's pretty remarkable, especially when you consider that Tabo Cephalosha, Kyle Korver are both coming off injury. They're not playing that many minutes. When you consider that Bazemore, their starter, has been out, that he hasn't even been able to play a single minute. That is remarkable and does not speak well for that trade.
It does not, especially with Jerian Grant playing pretty well up in New York. But the thing that I really don't like about that trade is, even if your theory is, okay, we're going to be able to develop this guy defensively and make him into something useful next year, well, that's the last year you have him for cheap on his rookie contract, and then he becomes either you have to sign him to an extension or he becomes a restricted free agent. So what's the point?
Well, even more than that, too, they won 60 games last year. These guys are like 29, 30. They need someone who's going to be good this year. You don't think you could have gotten someone who would have helped more this year with that pick? Now, granted, this was at the draft time, right? So they didn't want to take on salary. They didn't know what was going to happen with Carroll. Maybe they couldn't have acquired Splitter had they gotten someone with a higher salary. And part of the reason that Hardaway is available is because he had that low salary. You know, I mean, you could get someone who might have been good, but then, you know, maybe he's making $8 million a year or something like that. So maybe it's a little bit too harsh to criticize in that sense, but maybe you just draft the guy or draft someone with the 15th pick, hold on to him, and then you could make the trade during the season as well. I mean, it's certainly certainly discouraging results so far there, but you would have them in that tier. I guess I would. I would have them kind of at the bottom of that tier. I'm still not an Atlanta believer. And you know, but I mean, I think they'll win probably 48 games, 49 games, something like that. But I don't see them. Maybe it's just, I don't see the upside from this team as potentially being able to be the number two seed.
Yeah, I think,
because that's kind of what I'm thinking about this tier, is teams that might potentially get that number two seed.
I think that's fair. I just was so low on the Hawks that I don't want to underrate them now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's fair. You know, when they started 7-1, I was like, oh, was I wrong here? But then, you know, they've kind of regressed, so now there's worry about going too much in the opposite direction. Is that it for your tier of teams that might potentially be the number two seed?
I think so. It's hard to see Indiana or Washington getting that high at this point.
Yeah, and Detroit, their offense probably just not good enough.
Yeah, Detroit, I mean, they've played reasonably well. I had them in the playoffs before the season started because I think I had Miami out of it. And even though they've lived up to those expectations, just nobody at this point has lived down, has fallen out of the top eight in the East. So that might leave them on the outside looking in.
Yeah, and a couple of these teams are going to get injuries and kind of fall out of it, I think. All right.
Charlotte is probably the other team that we need to mention. They've got a positive point differential, you know, have been reasonably effective. So they're still very much in this mix.
Yeah, they've lost two straight, actually, without P.J. Hairston, of all people, who I think he's actually important for them just because he allows Marvin Williams to play more four. Not that he's like some amazing player on his own, but they just kind of need someone who you at least have to guard at the three-point line and can be somewhat passable on the wing defensively. You know, obviously they're not huge fans of him since they didn't even pick up his rookie option, which was weird. But yeah, I mean, they definitely, I mean, I think when you consider that they're bringing back relatively similar personnel from last year in some respects, the way that they've changed how they're playing is pretty remarkable.
Definitely. I mean, you know, to think about this time a year ago, the Hornets' problem being, hey, they need to start playing defense better, is hard to understand.
That's true. And they're just shooting a ton of threes as well. All right, so who then? I mean, all right, so we can assume that the Bulls, Atlanta, Miami, Boston, I think all of us have them solidly in the playoffs. So how many slots does that leave? That's like Bulls, Atlanta, Miami, Boston. So that leaves what? Two spots. Among Washington, Indiana, Toronto too. I guess we would.
Yes.
Would you say Toronto's a lock for the playoffs?
They're solidly in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they look pretty good too. So now what do we have? There's only one spot left at that point?
I think there's still two because
yeah.
Because Indiana, Washington, and Detroit are all in at this point, and Toronto isn't.
Right. All right. So Indiana, Washington, and Detroit, I would kind of make that the next tier to me above New York, Charlotte, and Orlando, despite them all having kind of similar records. Would you agree with that?
I would probably put Charlotte up into that tier.
Yeah. Well, so we do a little process of elimination. What is it about New York and Orlando that you don't have them in that tier?
I think the fact that I was much more skeptical about them before the season is a big factor in that. You know, New York, I mean, we do think that Porzingis is probably going to drop off a little bit. You know, their starting lineup is still not great. So, I don't know. I think it's really mostly about just starting with a lower expectation of them.
Yeah, the last time I looked at it, this team is basically entirely average on offense, defense, and pace, which is actually a fantastic, you know, I looked at it and I thought that they would be, you know, maybe just getting a little lucky. They did have that one first night blowout of the Bucks that was like kind of a weird game, but you know, you get those throughout the year, those even out. I think it's always kind of a little unfair to say, oh, well, if you take out this one game, you know, but early on in the year, I think there's a little bit more of an argument to do that when that can be really skewing the results. I agree with you. I don't think that they can quite continue to defend at this level. It feels like they've had a relatively easy schedule. Let me look at their SRS on Basketball Reference. Yeah, so they actually have a positive SRS, 0.39. SRS is basically kind of net rating adjusted for location and the teams that you've played. So I don't know, maybe they can keep it up, but yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately this team is going to kind of regress a little bit, but you know, still better than we thought that they would be. You know, I see them probably finishing kind of more in like the 35 win range ultimately.
Yeah, and maybe even high 30s in wins. The one other thing specifically, the opponents are only shooting 30% from three against them, and that generally does not have any predictive power the rest of the season.
Yeah, that's something that we've talked about a lot. What about Orlando? Why are they not on that list for you?
I watch them play, and I'm not sure how they're doing what they're doing besides for the force of Scott Skiles' will, you know, despite the talent, young talent they have, but oftentimes they're not even playing that young talent.
Right, yeah. Danny was not happy about that after he was, like, very, very excited to watch that Orlando-Minnesota game. But... Yeah, I mean, well, although, let's think about that, though. How much can we really be criticizing Skiles? I mean, who are the guys that he's not playing? He's not playing Hezonja. I think we can agree Hezonja is not really ready to be an effective winning basketball player at this point in his career, right?
Yeah. My issue is not really there.
Aaron Gordon, I think, is what it really comes down to, huh?
The other thing is, the guys who are playing ahead of Hezonja, you know, other than maybe if they play C.J. Watson at the two, those are all young guys. Those are all guys who are part of their future. The guys who are playing ahead of Gordon are Andrew Nicholson and Jason Smith.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that Fournier can keep this up either. I think also, like, C.J. Watson is someone who's been really important for them, with them playing pretty poorly with Peyton on the floor. And with Watson, you know, he always seems to miss, like, a third of the season with some kind of calf injury or hamstring or knee or something. So I think they're really going to need him. I don't trust Shabazz Napier as your backup point guard. And then Vucevic has always been a polarizing player. I still think that, you know, they don't seem to play very effectively with him on the court, but then they also don't really have an amazing backup center option. I mean, it's going to be Deadman without him, and he's kind of, you know, going to kill your offense. You can't have him and Peyton out there at the same time. So I don't know. I think Skiles is frustrating on the Gordon front, but I might be, other than him, you know, maybe it's not as bad as people are making it out to be.
Yeah, Orlando, like New York, also benefiting from a fair bit of three-point luck defensively.
Yeah, and they actually, unlike New York, has like a negative 1.39 SRS, although pretty much exactly even point differential so far. All right, so I agree with you. I think that neither of those two teams is going to make it. So give me your prediction then on which of Washington, Detroit, Indiana, Charlotte gets those last two spots.
I would go with Indiana and Washington.
I think that's probably got to be right. I mean, Washington has struggled. Beal has been out, but they still are lucky to be 5-4, probably, given what their differential is. Mm-hmm. I mean, some dumbass picked them to be the number one seed in the East. is not going to happen, I think we can say pretty reliably. And maybe if they get Alan Anderson back and can start playing true small ball more often, they could start to go on a run, but they could also just get more injuries just as easily, and it's such a thin team. I think that's kind of the biggest problem with them. But yeah, I can't imagine that a team with Wall and Beal is going to miss the playoffs. And Indiana, Paul George has just been so good. I think he can't necessarily keep this up with the way he's shooting, 50% on threes over his last like eight or so, and shooting great from mid-range. But I mean, their defense still has looked pretty good. And I believe in Vogel. So, yeah, I would say that's probably it. It does pain me to leave out Detroit, though.
Yeah, like I said, I think we like what they're building there. It's a fun style of play. And their bench might get better over the course of the season with Brandon Jennings' return.
Yeah, that's the thing that's killing them. Right? Like, their starters have been really good. It's just the B&B losing factory, as Danny calls them. I wouldn't be quite that harsh, but Steve Blake and Aaron Baines, whenever those two guys come on the court together, and usually I'd be critical of a coach like, all right, you're bringing out this all bench unit, but I think you want to play Drummond and Jackson together, and then there's not really anyone else that you can put on that unit who's going to save them. So I think they're just going to have to deal with that from now on. Until Jennings comes back, and who knows how effective he can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the original sin there was more signing Aaron Baines to the contract they gave him than the rotation now.
Yeah, that actually, I mean, that really is like right up there in terms of original sins with like, with Adam and Eve. I mean, that's like, there's casting all of humanity out of paradise and signing Aaron Baines to a 5-year contract. I think those are pretty much two, or a $5 million a year contract. Those are kind of like pretty much in the same category to me.
If you're a Detroit basketball fan, they are.
You time to do the West?
I mean, should we talk briefly about Milwaukee?
Oh, yeah. That's right. I totally forgot about them because they're kind of below Orlando in the standings. Yeah, we should talk maybe even more than briefly about Milwaukee. So do you kind of have them in the Orlando, New York tier?
I don't know if there's a tier between that and the write-off. I'm not ready to completely write them off, but I think there were concerns about them going into the season that they were going to take a step back this year, and they have even underperformed that fear thus far.
Yeah, they've had some weird blowout losses, had played much better when Jabari came back, and when I looked at it, I think it was obviously a very small sample, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but there's also a reason to believe that with him on the floor, you can do more of the switching that they like to do, and they've been pretty effective when he had played, and he had been starting too, so that's mostly going against starting units. But then again, he's out with his foot sprain now. He's coming back from the ACL. I don't know how hard they're really going to want to push him. And it might even be better ultimately for the franchise if they miss the playoffs this year and can get one more draft pick in. But I think it's still possible that if Jabari comes back, OJ Mayo also has been out. I thought that the bench was going to be a strength of this team, and instead they've had to play guys like Copeland and O'Brien, and probably playing Grievous Vasquez too many minutes. Mayo is another guy who can get some shooting. I think Middleton can start playing better offensively when he doesn't have to handle quite as much of the shot creation load. So I'm not quite ready to write these guys off yet, but I did have them missing the playoffs, and I am not really willing to change that prediction at all.
So first, they're 29th in defensive rating, which is shocking given where they were last season. And then also, is this the second consecutive season that the team that has traded Jared Dudley has subsequently needed a Jared Dudley type?
Yes. I think it is. Although, I feel better about that from the Bucks. I mean, I guess both of those teams he was coming off an injury-plagued year in Los Angeles, and then, you know, not that I think that was a good trade to give up a first-round pick to dump him for a year or two, but, and then Milwaukee, he needed this back surgery, and he hasn't been effective at all so far in Washington. You know, maybe he can get back to there, but he's a guy who traditionally kind of struggles to get back in shape from injuries as well, and his, like, body composition is always a big factor in his success. So I don't know if you can say that, like, you know, if they'd kept him, they would have been better off, at least for right now.
Yeah, he had a good game the other night, so hopefully that's the start of something. But when the alternative is Johnny O'Brien?
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And I mean, and also Dudley kind of came back earlier. I mean, I don't think he was even supposed to be back quite yet at this point.
Right.
So, yeah, that's it's true. They could use him, but, you know, I think if Jabari comes back and can play well, I'm not ready to write them off. I just think that the odds of that are maybe not as high as you might hope, especially now that he's suffered another setback injury.
Yeah.
All right, so we got time to do the West here. I'll try and keep it quick for you since I know your time is extremely valuable. You have to go for a run and listen to last night's podcast, right?
I do, yeah.
All right, we have written off the Lakers and New Orleans. I think we're about ready on Portland. Sacramento has been pretty good with Boogie. They had a competitive loss even last night against the Hawks, although they had some troubling signs just in the way that they lost, I thought, just with a lot of mental mistakes and lack of effort. But still, they're 4-4 with Cousins in the lineup, but only 1-7 against the West. I mean, what do you think of this team? We can talk about writing them off, but they've got like a lot of guys, or a lot of teams that are ahead of them.
Right. I mean, I think that's the biggest obstacle is, you know, they're in a group with Sacramento, with Denver and Minnesota, I feel like, in this conference. And both of those teams have actually started better than them.
I would actually be willing to write off Denver right now with Chandler being out for the year. I think, yeah, they're 6-6. But, you know, they've had two big wins against the Rockets funk. You know, they beat the Lakers. I just don't see any way. Nurkic is still going to be out for a while. I don't know that he's even, you know, a winning basketball player yet in his career. LaVerne is still out. This is just, I don't think they have the firepower, especially with Chandler out for the year. I wouldn't write them off if they had Chandler coming back, but I think there's just no chance that team makes the playoffs.
I'm not ready to say no chance, and one reason why is they've had to play J.J. Hickson so far, and whatever you think about Nurkic at this point of his career coming off an injury, he's not J.J. Hickson.
Yeah, and even if you bring back LaVerne, you can get rid of Hickson.
Yep.
I will stick with my write-off prediction. Every time we say write-off, I always think of Jerry Seinfeld, where Kramer is like, it's a write-off for them at the post office. And Jerry's like, you don't even know what writing it off is. But anyway, let's see. Houston, I think just you have to still think that they're in it. I mean, they're only, what, two games out of the playoffs, one game out of the playoffs right now. So I don't think that their game against Portland last night was at all encouraging that they've turned it around. That was a pretty – I mean, they were down 15 at the start of the fourth quarter against a team that hasn't been playing well. So, but they're not, like, so far in the hole that I'm ready to write them off yet.
Yeah, especially when you go back to the importance of preseason expectations and how high they were for this team that some people thought would even finish first in the West.
How about Minnesota?
Yeah, they've been pretty solid so far. Zach LaVine's playing a lot better lately. I mean, you know, they've got a quality starting lineup. Rubio injury is probably the biggest concern to me.
Yeah, if you could tell me for sure that Rubio was only going to miss like five more games the rest of the year, I might be willing to buy them as staying in the race all year. But I just don't think that that necessarily is going to happen. I still think that the amount that they're playing Tayshaun Prince is somewhat troubling. And I just don't quite trust Rubio's health and the coaching enough. I think that, you know, I'm not going to write them off completely, but I'd say, you know, 5% chance that they make the playoffs ultimately.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. I mean, where does BPI have them? Has them at, I think, at 15%. I guess it's much better, but
Yeah, it is, and it, how much of that is based on preseason expectations?
It's relatively similar to what I outlined. I think the one big thing that BPI can't take into account is teams that have, you know, suffered because of injury to date.
Yeah, and the Wolves, 0.87 SRS so far, anything above zero is obviously pretty decent. And I think if they could maintain that all year, a plus one differential, I think would probably, efficiency differential, that probably gets you in the West this year.
It certainly gets you close.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. What do you think? How many wins do you think it takes you to get into the West playoffs this year?
So I made a friendly wager with the aforementioned Ben Golliver before this, early in the season, that the eighth seed in the East would have more wins than the eighth seed in the West.
Oh.
And I don't know how I'm feeling about that because, you know, certainly the East looks deep based on that conversation we just had, but the West now looks a little deeper, I think, than we thought because Dallas is so much better than expected, and then Phoenix, it looks like, is going to be better than expected.
Yeah, what Dallas is doing is, that might even be a bigger surprise to me than New York and Minnesota at this point for me. I mean, that's an interesting question. Yeah, what team's performance is most surprising to you right now?
Let's see. I mean, I think you probably could say Dallas because not the...
But on the positive side, I think we know, I would say New Orleans and Houston, obviously, on the negative side are probably, you know, pretty obvious there, but for the biggest overall surprise. But yeah, you think Dallas?
You might be able to make a case for Cleveland under kind of this similar case because we thought this was going to be the worst stretch of Dallas's season. It's like, can they survive this enough to still be in the playoff hunt on December 1st? And instead, not only are they still in the playoff hunt, right now they're third. They haven't played quite that well, but that's crazy.
Yeah, that is pretty remarkable. It's interesting in kind of going over my preseason expectations. I picked Cleveland to start poorly and not get the number one seed, and Dallas to not be that good because of injuries. They've managed to overcome those. On the other hand, I said New Orleans was going to be under. That definitely has been the case. You know, you would say in large part because of injuries. And there's another team, too, I can't remember who's doing poorly that I thought wouldn't be that good because of injuries, but I can't remember it right now. But maybe there wasn't, actually, now that I look at it. But anyway, yeah, it's always – injuries are always like a tough way – to try to make a prediction because it's like you're in the middle and it's either, you know, the injuries don't matter that much or they seem to matter a lot and you end up like either being wrong either way sometimes it seems like.
Well, I mean, it's just so hard to predict when Wesley Matthews and Chandler Parsons were going to be able to come back.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's just I generally am more pessimistic about injuries than a lot of people are. I mean, yeah, maybe you could say Milwaukee would be the other one that you know, has kind of struggled, even though they're 5-6 right now, due to injuries. All right, where were we here? So, let's see. Golden State and San Antonio, I think we can agree they're easily the top tier so far. Are those your picks for the 1 and 2 seed?
For sure. That was what I had coming into the season, and definitely nothing to change that opinion so far.
Yeah, San Antonio, what they're doing, a little bit underrated. They are now over a 10 net rating, 9-1 in their last 10 games. 1-6 in a row. You know, their only two losses are totally fine losses. Yeah, I think, and they've had some nice wins. They beat Boston in Boston, which actually is looking like a pretty darn good win. So, yeah, I would agree there. That's kind of tier one for me. Tier two for me would be Clippers, Oklahoma City. Would you agree with that as well?
I would, yeah.
Who do you like better out of those two teams to get the 3 seed?
I guess Oklahoma City because they still have a better point differential and they've dealt with, obviously, a much worse injury than the Clippers have.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, with KD being out. And they've managed to keep the ship pretty steady with that. They were somewhat buoyed by an easy schedule in that regard. We had a dinner at Summer League in which you said you were not as high on Oklahoma City as some of the rest of us. Before the season, I was sort of talking about Golden State being in one tier and then San Antonio and Oklahoma City being the next tier. Oklahoma City has not quite lived up to that so far. Your reasoning was Deion Waiters and Enes Kanter are going to drag down the amazing players that they have. Do you feel like that prediction has come true so far, and will that continue?
I do. I mean, I think specifically it was, would you have, you know, Oklahoma City in the same tier as like San Antonio and Cleveland if suddenly Dion Waiters and Kanter were off the roster? And my answer to that was yes. I mean, if you look at, you know, their net rating so far, it's similar. It's basically the same thing as years past. They're terrific with their starters on the court, with Durant and Westbrook. They're, you know, plus 10 basically with all of their starters except Ibaka. And then their bench is, you know, basically playing even, plus 2.5 with Waiters on the court, plus 1.5 with Kanter. And it's just, I mean, it's exactly playing out as we expected. Kanter is putting up great statistics individually, and they can't stop anyone when he's on the court.
Yeah, and Jeremias Engelman, who I know is a buddy of yours, who's involved in creating ESPN's RPM, and he's been lamenting on Twitter that they play Waiters every second and fourth quarter, basically, and you know, they start off just fine in the fourth quarter and end up down afterwards after playing him, I guess. But so this is my question, though. What is the alternative to playing Waiters? I mean, Kanter, I think, you know, they're using him about how he should be used if you're going to have him on the roster. You know, maybe you try to get him with Ibaka a little bit more, but I don't have a huge amount of quibbles with that. But with Waiters, how would you be using him differently? Would you be closing with someone else, and who would that be? Because the rest of those players all have their flaws, too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at this point it's become less a Waiters-Kanter issue and more, and this is something you've highlighted, how they could possibly have used all their trade assets, the two picks and Reggie Jackson, not come up with a single quality 3-and-D wing. And people wanted to make the case that Singler was that guy. They've been pretty good defensively with him on the court, but he's just been a complete mess offensively.
Yeah, I did think I liked that trade. I thought that both he and Augustine could really help them. Both of those guys have kind of disappointed to me so far. I mean, especially Singler, the fact, like, who would have predicted that he just, like, couldn't hit a shot once he got there? I mean, he's, like, he's shooting, like, 30% on twos or something, like, since he's been in Oklahoma City. It's remarkable. Yeah, it is a concern. I mean, should they just go with Roberson down the stretch?
It's tough because, you know, his shooting weakness, I think, is magnified in the fourth quarter and probably will also be in the playoffs. But they are just terrific defensively anytime he's on the court. So maybe that overcomes it. I mean, you know, certainly in terms of RPM.
That starting lineup with him and Adams in the game, that is a very tough nut to crack defensively.
Yeah, and maybe just grind out games and hope to live with the fact that their teams are going to double Durant and Westbrook every time off of Roberson.
Yeah, and you just hope that those guys can do enough. And if the other team doesn't have good individual defenders on KD and Russ, maybe you say, all right, you know, they're not going to just double Durant 25 feet from the basket on an ISO. Like, that's not really, like, you know, the last time we saw a player get treated that way really was Jordan, maybe Kobe in some of his best moments. You know, usually at the very least, you'll just kind of bring the help over. And so maybe you say, all right, you know, we'll just let these guys try to create mid-rangers and then just stop them on the other end.
Yeah, it's worth a try at this point, I guess.
It's an imperfect solution. And Waiters, at least, like, the one thing you can say about him is that in the games that KD and Russ have been there, at least he hasn't been shooting them out of the games. Now, that's partially because they just never passed it to him. But if you're never going to pass it to him, like, why bother having him out there? I mean, they're not respecting him, like, so much or anything. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe Morrow should get a chance. He now, everyone always says that, but, I mean, there hasn't been a single coach he's played for that's trusted his defense. So I think you have to ultimately conclude that there's a reason that he hasn't played for so many coaches in so many situations down the stretch.
Yeah.
Despite the fact he's like a 45% career three-point shooter or whatever he is.
And the fact that no one has ever even been willing to start him. They've basically exclusively brought him off the bench his entire career.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. Would it be absolutely crazy to put Utah in the same tier with the Clippers and Oklahoma City?
I think it'd be maybe a little bit premature. I mean,
I agree with you, but it's something, maybe something to sort of think about.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a plus 3.7 differential. They've played 8 of their first 11 on the road, and we know that they tend to have a better home court advantage than most teams.
Yeah, I would love. I don't think they've played any of those. I mean, I would have them pretty solidly fifth in the West. Would you agree with that right now?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I think even kind of given the way that Memphis and Houston have played so far, you know, I think that they're kind of fifth in the West in a tier by themselves. I really would like to see them play against one of those other top four teams in the West at full strength and try to kind of get a little bit more of a sense of how they really match up with those squads, because it's a team that, watching them, they don't look that explosive. They play at an extremely slow pace. They have this closing lineup without a point guard. They play this traditional style with two bigs, and yet their defense is awesome, and they win games, and they look very good statistically. So, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what to make of them, but I think any Jazz fan, despite the 6-5 record, should be feeling very, very positively about this team, even compared to what yours and mine were probably both had them beating the over or the over-under of like 40, which is what they started at.
Yeah, I think it's even more than what they've done so far. It's really about the fact that the West looks much more wide open after the top four, and maybe even including the top four, than we thought.
Yeah, I don't think there weren't a lot of people who had them as better than Memphis, Houston, and New Orleans, but I think I'm at the point now where I would predict that Utah would finish with a better record than all those teams.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right, so that's 1-5. So we got 3 spots left. What is your next tier of teams there?
So I think Memphis is still pretty solidly the 6th best team in this conference, in my opinion. Obviously, the differential is terrible, but so much of that is 2 games, and they've looked pretty normal the last couple of games. So I would probably have them, then Dallas, Phoenix, and Houston fighting for the last 2 spots.
Okay, so you think Memphis, you like Memphis over Dallas at this point?
I do.
Yeah, I don't know. I still want to kind of stick with my preseason expectations, but part of my preseason expectations were that this team could be pretty good as long as they stayed healthy. I mean, Parsons and Matthews have both looked pretty good. Parsons is only playing 20 minutes a game, but he hasn't looked appreciably worse than last year in the minutes that I've seen so far. I mean, the Mavs are sort of like Bulls West in some respects. They have about that their same really good record and only a 2.7 net rating at the moment. But I think I would have to put them a little bit ahead of Memphis at this point. And part of the reason for that is Memphis's defense, I think, is looking like it's going to take a step back this year to me.
It certainly has so far, where they've been among the worst defensive teams in the league.
Yeah, and Gasol, I think he may be at a different point now than he was back when he was Defensive Player of the Year. And Tony Allen isn't as good as he was before, and you know, is probably less playable than he ever has been. Although, to his credit, he actually has been shooting jumpers a little bit better this year so far, at least being willing to take them and take some of those corner threes. I guess I would put Dallas a little bit ahead of Memphis at this point, especially given how well Dirk has looked. But, I think I would have those two in the same tier at this point.
So then what do you think about Phoenix?
Well, what do you think about Phoenix?
Well, we had a conversation on either Twitter or GChat at one point before the season where I said that my head did not like Phoenix, but my heart for some reason still thought that they were going to be a playoff team.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, so do you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, all the projections had them as about a 38-win team thereabouts, but just something about the defensive potential of that team really got me excited, and so far I think they've lived up to that. I mean, they're, you know, 12th in the league in defensive rating.
Yeah, I mean, when is the last time that Phoenix had a good defense? I mean, you'd have to go back to the Skiles era, I think, for that. And they have a lot of guys who can play pretty well defensively. I still worry that they don't have anyone who is that good on the wing, and Jimmy Butler killed them last night in part of that, because of that. You know, Tucker is someone who tries hard but doesn't really have the length or the quickness to really lock down the best guys, and then you're going to someone like TJ Warren who's not ready to be in that role. And then the other thing that I think for them too is the Markieff situation's got to get sorted out. Either they got to start playing him a lot less, or he's got to start playing better. And I don't think although I'm not willing to say that over the course of the year they're going to be better without him or with him in a lesser role, but I don't think it's a coincidence that they went on a nice little run in the games that he missed.
Well, there is a third option, of course, which is trade.
Yeah, that's true too, but if he continues to play terribly, I think they're going to try to just rehabilitate him instead.
It'd be interesting if Houston keeps struggling like this, whether they become more interested in a Morris trade.
Huh, that is interesting. Yeah, and I don't know. And Markieff is still young enough where he could develop like real three-point range at some point, and he has been shooting more of those this year. So maybe there is some hope there, but a lot of his value, too, is the fact that he can make those turnaround jumpers in the post, and maybe you don't really want that as the staple of an offense. I think this team ultimately is going to need a little of that because they only, in somewhat similar fashion to Portland, they really kind of only have two shot creators on the team, although they have a guy like Warren coming off the bench. I don't know if you want to rely on him. I don't know. I mean, what's your gut feeling on them ultimately making the playoffs? I mean, the next tier, I mean, I guess they would be in the tier with, what, Houston, Minnesota, and then, yeah, I guess that's another question is whether Houston is in the same tier as, like, Memphis and Dallas at this point still.
I probably would still have them at the bottom of that tier. I think that they've got a reasonable chance of winning 41 games.
What do you think is Houston's problem so far?
I mean, it really does seem to be a lot about effort. I mean, Seth Partnow had those, you know, great numbers yesterday about the runouts that they're allowing, and that is the one thing that I took from yesterday's game against Portland is they didn't look a lot better offensively, although a lot of their woes there are just not making threes whatsoever, and I can't see that continuing all season. But they finally did seem to show some effort and pride in the fourth quarter and overtime of that game, and that really is what they've been missing.
Yeah, maybe that's true, although they've had some blips. I mean, they beat Oklahoma City at home. They don't do that by, like, not trying at all.
Right.
And that was a full-strength Oklahoma City. You know, they beat the Clippers on the road, although that was without Chris Paul. Yeah, I'm not ready to write them off either for the playoffs. I am willing to write them off. I think I would be very surprised if they finish ahead of Utah at this point. But I think they could easily get up to, like, the sixth seed still. My bigger problem is, yeah, I think the effort has been bad. But I also just don't think, you know, Lawson has not looked good either in terms of his role. And he was on the bench when they did that comeback yesterday, which I failed to note on yesterday's program. But he hasn't looked good even, you know, when he has been kind of on with the second unit. I think Harden doesn't look as good either. You know, I mean, he's had some big games just because he has such a high usage and he's a good shooter and can kind of heat up and get to the foul line sometimes, but he doesn't have quite the burst. And, you know, it's been acknowledged from reporting that he just wasn't in the greatest shape coming into camp. And then the biggest thing, I think, actually, is that Howard, to me, looks way, way less explosive. You know, like, they threw him this one alley-oop yesterday where he just came down with it, ended up getting an and one. But I was like, how did he not dunk that? Like, this is Dwight Howard. So those three guys, just watching them, I'm like, I just don't think that those guys are as good this year as the hope was.
I would agree with that. It was interesting to me that it seemed like the Blazers last night were treating Dwight Howard like he was Dwight Howard, and it just wasn't quite matching what we've seen from him this season. With Lawson,
yeah, I mean,
I think, you know, there's the chance to cut his minutes even further when they have a healthy Patrick Beverley. I mean, I think that's probably how they looked at this before the season. Like, you know, worst case scenario, oh, we're going to have to play Patrick Beverley and Jason Terry at point guard. That's what we did last year.
Yeah, that's true, too. Gut feeling right now, does Houston cut Ty Lawson and with that $13 million non-guarantee that he graciously, maybe not, I don't know, but agreed to include when he came to Houston?
We could use a few different adjectives for that decision. But, yeah, I mean, before last night, I haven't updated it today, but him and Corey Brewer were the two worst players in the league in terms of wins above replacement player. So if he's going to play like that, he's not going to coexist well with Harden, then, yeah, I think there's a better use of that $10 million.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, I thought the odds that that would end up happening was pretty low. I'm quite certain that he did as well. But yeah, that's a good reason to not make $13 million of your contract non-guaranteed for no reason. And frankly, I bet you they do that deal anyway, even if he doesn't agree to it.
The one interesting thing that was pointed out to me by my editor, Royce Webb, a couple days ago that I had forgotten about is that pick is not only lottery protected, but it immediately converts to a second round pick if they miss the playoffs. So they really are protected in terms of the worst case scenario.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and I think also just with his alcoholism problems and his age as kind of a short point guard, really relying on quickness, he has not had the burst so far this year, from what I can tell. I think that's fine for Denver. I mean, that was all they could get from him at that point, and that's what ended up happening. Maybe you could say they should have traded him earlier. All right, are we done here? What else do we need to talk about here in the West?
I think that mostly covers it.
Yeah. All right, awesome. I've kept you for far too long. Anything else that you wanted to touch on or anything that you want to plug before we go?
Have a piece up today on whether Steph Curry is playing point guard better than anyone since Magic, which kind of inevitably requires comparing him to Chris Paul leading up to their game tonight.
Oh, that's interesting. You shouldn't tell it. I'll just go read the piece immediately after we sign off. How about that? That's probably a better way of doing things. And my answer to that this year would be that I think he is, just because I think his shooting is like breaks defenses so much, even though like Paul had those two unbelievable 08 and 09 years from kind of a box score perspective. But be interested to see what your conclusion is.
Yeah, I mean, the trick of posing the question now is obviously the first 12 games have been better than anyone. The first 12 games have been better than anyone has played a full season ever in NBA history. So how much can we really glean from that over the full 82?
Yeah. Where do you fall on the, like, is Steph Curry the best player in basketball? Based on what he's done, obviously we expect him to regress. Do you think it's clear that he's the best player in basketball now, or are you not willing to go there yet?
No, I'm definitely willing to go there. I mean, I still think it's a legitimate debate because of the fact that LeBron may have a ceiling that is higher than Steph Curry's. But to me at this point, I think you have to say that he is.
Yeah, when is the last time LeBron actually reached that ceiling, though, is my question.
The finals. Wouldn't you say he did in the finals?
No. This actually might be something to talk about because I thought that Steph Curry should have been the MVP. I thought that LeBron did not really have that great of a finals, frankly.
Really? Wow. Oh, so
I think I was leading the
charge of the LeBron for MVP on the losing team.
Well, all right. How good could he have been if the team overall scored like 93 points per 100 possessions in the finals?
I mean, I think you have to look at it from the standpoint of, to some extent, that was strategic to just try to slow everything down, take the Warriors out of their fast break almost entirely, and make these games into slogs. And I don't think that there's anyone else who could have made that a viable, workable strategy other than LeBron.
Yeah, all right. Maybe that worked defensively a little bit. But to me, the guy shot, what was it, 38%? He couldn't hit a jumper. I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, if he could have just made jump shots in that series, then I think I would have totally been on board. But he just wasn't hitting his jumper, and that really had some ramifications. He had to just, like, go and try to bludgeon in. Also, like, whenever they put Iguodala on him, I thought he was very, very ineffective. A lot of his, what he was able to do was when they would go with Barnes or someone, and once they wised up and just went with Andre in the starting lineup, his production really decreased a lot. I mean, to me, I feel like the burden is on everyone else. And because he was really inefficient and his team was really inefficient. So you have a long way to go to me to prove that he had a good series and should have been the MVP given those two facts.
I mean, I think, you look at the amount of load he was shouldering offensively is historic. I mean, better than 40% usage rate. And the other thing is, obviously, he wasn't as efficient as a shooter, but he also had a very low turnover rate despite handling the ball all that time. And I think those two factors, again, it's basically a team that's running the ball for maybe they're running the ball for only 4 yards a carry, and you're not going to score very many points that way. But you're extending drives, you're keeping the opponent off the field, and that's the only, like, the fact that they won two games in that series with the talent they had is borderline miraculous. In hindsight,
maybe it is, but as you noted, before that series, they were pretty much just as good in the East as, and that was even a lot without Kyrie, as the Warriors were in the West.
Yeah. I mean, I think Kyrie was a fair bit of it, and a lot of it was with LeBron playing a relatively similar style. I mean, it's not like it was a complete departure what he was doing in the finals.
Yeah. No, I mean, that might be true. I would also say, though, what happens if Matthew Dellavedova doesn't get that tip in game two and they lose it in five games and LeBron plays the exact same way otherwise? Are you even making this argument at that point?
Probably not.
Yeah, see, that's another one to me. I just, like, there's this perception that, he was so good, they're keeping the series close, they had a 2-1 lead, but, you know, I think a lot of that was just kind of the luck in close games, and if you look at the last three games of that series, I don't think he was really any good in any of those three games, from what I recall, and they got blown out, and overall, over the course of the series, they got blown out. It's just that they happened to steal one that was pretty close in that game, too.
I mean, they easily could have won game one and probably should have won game one, so I don't think the luck was quite as favorable for them. But then also in game five, he had 40 points, 14 rebounds, 11 assists, so I thought he was pretty good in that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, what did he shoot from the field in that game?
15 of 34.
Yeah, it's actually not that terrible. So I don't know. It's
the rest of the team was 14 of 47, or no, 17 of 47. My math was bad there.
Yeah, but and I thought Ethan had a good point, which was the strategy for the Warriors was, because you could say, Cleveland had this strategy to just give it to him all the time, but on the other hand, if you're going to make that argument, you have to acknowledge that the strategy for the Warriors was let him get his points and don't let anyone else score. And when the strategy is let the guy get his points and he's still really inefficient, that I think is, you know, a little bit of an indictment there as well.
I mean, I think you have to start from the perspective that going up against the Warriors, like whatever strategy they choose is probably going to work because they're the Warriors and they have the best defense in the league. And that's why they are a historically great team and won the title.
Yeah. And it's also kind of funny to me, too, that it's like, oh, yeah, you know, the reason he deserves MVP is because the other team was so good. I don't know. I still think he was being guarded one-on-one for very large portions of that series and was not able to be efficient. And that's ultimately what it boils down to me. It's not like they're like, all right, we're going to double this guy every time. You know, Iguodala stopped him. And I think that was pretty clear to me is that when Iguodala was on him, he wasn't really able to do much.
All right, consider the question from this way. Let's say you flip Steph and LeBron to opposite teams, and they play at precisely the same overall level, but in...
Well, that's not fair, though. I mean, you have to then, like, put in an average guy replacing them at their position as well.
I mean, I suppose you could probably could make it work with those two rosters because they were versatile enough that, Cleveland would just play more small ball. Golden State would play more big ball, but... I mean, is the point differential better or worse than it actually was? Is the series more lopsided, I guess?
Well, okay, so I mean, this is one is like whether LeBron had this awesome series. I mean, the other one is who deserved the MVP. I don't know. I think that Steph is a better offensive player overall than LeBron. I think I bet you Cleveland would have scored more than 93 points per 100 possessions if Steph were on that team.
That's probably true, yeah.
Because you have a way with, I mean, when you have Steph and you have four total schlubs around him, you still have a way to get a decent shot pretty much every possession just by running a Steph pick and roll and forcing them to double team.
Yeah.
And granted, Cleveland was kind of, and this whole idea that the supporting cast was just so terrible, that supporting cast looked great for, 15 games before that.
That is true. I mean, ultimately, their offensive ratings from the Dean Oliver metric on Basketball Perspectives were identical in the series. They both had 104.
You're talking about Steph and LeBron?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Steph, if he hadn't just shot 5 out of 23 or 5 out of 22 or whatever in that game two somewhat inexplicably, if he had just had like kind of even like you know, 8 out of 23, then I think he probably ends up like winning the MVP, no problem. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I realize I have an uphill climb here on this one with LeBron just killing it so much in the traditional statistics. But I think ultimately, if he had been really inefficient and the team had even been like, you know, 20th in the league style offensive rating, I mean, they had a worse offensive rating than like by like 6 points per 100 possessions than the Warriors' average opponent during the year.
Yeah, and if that's, I mean, that's hard to argue against, I suppose. I mean, I guess it just ultimately comes back to if you consider them fairly equally efficient when you factor in assists and turnovers. I mean, obviously Steph was much more efficient in terms of scoring efficiency, and LeBron was using 40% of possessions while Steph was using 30%. That to me is a pretty enormous advantage.
Yeah, that's true. And you, I mean, the argument that LeBron was almost intentionally inefficient because it slowed the game down, you know, prevented the Warriors from getting out on the fast break, etc. I mean, I'm not totally blind to that argument, but I think that that is sort of like, you know, if you look at the simplest explanation, that's like a lot of leaps that you have to kind of make, as opposed to the fact that just they couldn't score and he couldn't score efficiently. And, you know, I don't think that his defense was, I thought his defense was okay, but it wasn't, you know, anything amazing. All right, I've kept you for far too long here. Unless you want to get a parting shot on this argument, I will allow you that, and then we can get you out of here.
All right, my parting shot is that LeBron averaged nearly 9 assists per game, which is pretty good for someone that the other team was allowing to score and not double-teaming.
All right, much as it pains me as an attorney to not respond to that at all, I will do so. You've got guests right on this one. We'll definitely check out your work at ESPN.com. For us, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Kevin is K Pelton, much shorter. I'm a little jealous of that because that means you get to write more in each individual tweet, I guess, or when people respond to you, maybe that means they get to write more. But maybe that's actually a bad thing. I don't know. All right, and also if you want to support the show, an iTunes review or rating is something that we really appreciate. That's been instrumental in our success, and will continue to be going forward, I hope. And also by going to one of our sponsors, Stance, or using the cap space code on DraftKings or SeatGeek. So thanks again to Kevin for coming on. We will talk to you all next time.